He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good morning to our listeners, presuming you're listening in the morning version of this week's car show. Jada Markin and I are here. It's actually in 2024. And we have been, at the time of this taping, blessed with a snowstorm in our broadcasting area and around much of the Northeast, which will give us some discussion topics to discuss about driving in such conditions, which I did a lot of over the last couple of days when the storm was in full force. One of the things we have talked about on this show in the past is tread wear condition and the results of potential problems if you didn't have very good tread wear left on any of your tires, whether they be snow, all weather, or just plain driving tires, having to do with the topic called aquaplaning, talking about that in rain conditions when the tires lose contact with the pavement due to a film of water that builds up under them when people are going at certain speeds where aquaplaning can become a going event. And it can be at varying speeds depending on the tread depth left in your tires. This, too, can happen in snowy conditions in a different sort of way, but the same condition affects the drivability or non-drivability, steerability, that is, of a car when you hit slushy sections of the road, as I did in Vermont over the past couple of days, and watch people in a line of traffic in which I was in the middle of by the time I got into it, going down a fairly steep, long, graded hill with a couple of turns in it and long straightaways. And we were all crawling at between, I would say, 20 and 30 miles an hour going down this hill following the leader, which was many cars ahead. But you have varying distances between cars, and you have to watch very carefully at the car in front of you or the car, two cars, if you can see that far, which you can on curves, as to what is going on when one of them starts slipping and sliding. And that's usually caused by when you're on a pavement or a pathway where there's some pavement visible and slushy areas on top. And when the cars get out of the pavement areas where they might have good contact with the pavement and hit the slushy parts, that's when the problems start. So this was a storm. Go ahead, Jay.
Can I interject for a second?
Yeah.
Speaking of driving under very, very tricky conditions, snowy conditions that you're mentioning, most modern cars, and, you know, it is my most modern car, is a 2015 Volkswagen Touareg. And you turn the dial from normal driving to snow mode, and it really is unbelievable what the electronics are going to be able to do for you. So
that is true.
But most people don't know how to use it, and it's just a turn of the dial. And it's available on most SUVs, which a lot of people around here use, drive, and a lot of them are newer than mine. So those modes exist, and they do work. They do serve a purpose.
Well,
in my car, you can go down a very steep driveway at crawl speed, and just take your hands totally off the brake and the gas, and the car will go down at walking speed down the steep driveway. So
that is fine to hear on your car. That does not happen very well on Jeeps, which I have owned several of, which has a knob with regular auto snow, rock and mud, and sport in the case of my Jeeps. And the snow mode does nothing on the decline, that is coasting situation, to help saying what you say they might do. It helps is that it puts the transmission in a higher gear on starting up. And so instead of starting in first gear where you have a lot of torque and wheel spin, it puts it into second or third where you have less torque and the wheels will not spin as aggressively, giving you better traction on startup. But they do not work going down the hill, Jay. and the Touareg and Land Rovers and Range Rovers and expensive cars may have a very good braking effect in their snow mode knob, but it is not prevalent on the lower levels of lower pace cars, as far as I know. And I have not driven many, so I can't say this is a gospel. Okay, but what I wanted to say, and I want to close, is that when your tires are not actually in contact with the pavement is when you are going to see people sliding sideways a little bit as they aggressively try to get back on the pavement, or they hit the brakes because they feel like they're sliding, and anti-lock brakes do not stop you any better in some instances, but they may keep. And people do not know how to drive with anti-lock brakes either. So the end result is, in uncertain conditions, go a lot more slowly than you might otherwise like to go. And that's it, I think, for that.
Yeah, that's the obvious, obviously. Slow it down. But if you're already going slow, actually, you're talking about how to drive with anti-lock brakes. If you're going to use any, if you want the anti-lock to work, there's only one thing to do, is just push on the pedal and let the electronics do their thing.
Well, my opinion on that is absolutely, I agree. But I think people who get these vehicles with these new technology types of driving capabilities, if they were really wanting to know what these things did, they would go out and test them in a safe zone like a big parking lot and run through the different modes and try to figure out what the car was doing. And I don't think 90% of the people do that, which is too bad. Anyways, moving on. Old cars and airbag lights on dashes. I want to go. Jay and I talked about this a little bit before coming on air. And my question and my notes are, when you have an older car, and I have one that goes back to 2001, I have one that goes back to 2004, and recently we saw an accident happen around our broadcast area in which a 1995 Volvo crashed. And part of the somebody died, and part of the information in the police report was that the airbags did not deploy, and this car ended up hitting a tree head on. In most normal cases, airbags apparently do not deploy necessarily unless the car is traveling at over 15 miles an hour. I think that's the standard of the safety situation. This Volvo appeared to probably have been doing much more than that. And I have two vehicles in my fleet of old cars down around 2001 and 2004 with airbag lights on, and I cannot get dealers or people to be able to tell me whether they will go off or not should I have an accident. And so everybody listening, if you're driving an older car and you think and they have airbags, and whether the airbag light's on or not, your airbags might not work, and you will never know until you will have wanted to know in advance if you were to have an unfortunate accident in which an airbag should theoretically have fired off and saved you from a high impact inside the car injury.
So,
Jay, you have any comment?
Yeah, just a little safety tidbit, and we can come back to safety later. But obviously, wearing a seatbelt will help you a lot, and airbags will not replace a seatbelt.
Correct.
I think the latest crash fatality reports indicate that 40% of the people who die in car crashes were not wearing seatbelts.
That's frightening.
It is frightening, and so it's a very simple thing, and you know, enough said. Just click it, or
watch out.
Yeah, I don't like it. The click it or ticket.
No, I know you
line
didn't want to
say Massachusetts that. DOT uses on the side of the road, but it works. Anyway,
okay. You want to cover this topic before I cover my next one?
Go for
our listeners. Go for it. Okay, go for it.
Yeah.
I've been watching. We've been off the air for some weeks or months until this particular show and a couple of prior shows have come back on the air. And it's allowed Jay and I to sit there and watch the market mature in both the electric car world and the regular fossil fuel car world, because people are becoming more intelligent and more knowledgeable about the operation of electric vehicles, which have a lot of advantages for some, probably no advantages for others. But the area which is becoming more knowledgeable, maybe because there are stories being put out there, are topics such as how do the battery ranges vary between weather conditions? And we have a lot of weather condition variables in the United States. In the wintertime, you go in the northern half of the country towards the Canadian border, you have a lot of bitterly cold weather. And in the summertime, you go to some of the hotter places in the country with very hot temperatures, let's say 100 degrees or more a day. And you have a lot of parked cars, and these are all cars with electric vehicles, as I'm referring to with this comment. Apparently, what's being learned in this gestation period of the oncoming electric car world, you have variable problems with the batteries in these cars in both very hot conditions and very cold conditions with respect to performance, mainly dealing with the concept of range. And there's been a lot of range anxiety out there. The ads for the ranges, range levels given in the ads for electric cars are not bringing up the topic of weather conditions may cause variable range adjustments between what we're advertising. And you don't know about that problem until it happens to you in maybe a very unfortunate traffic type of condition, like being on the interstate in a snowstorm. Jay will comment about electric range in electric car, but the problem of cars getting stuck in on interstate or any kind of road in a big storm, and you're way far away from a service station where there might be charging stations and or gasoline for fossil fuel cars, incidentally.
I do have to barge in here because
go ahead.
And I don't remember the stats exactly, but following last year's big storm on I-95, and this was, I don't even remember. I think it was in the southern states, but I don't know if it was just in Virginia or Maryland. But cars were stuck on I-95 for hours, I think close to 24 hours. And, you know, some people, just like you're mentioning right now, Robin, thought that the electric cars would be a problem and that it would all run out of battery and be dead on the side of the road. Well, guess what? Most people with electric cars fared just fine, and the people with gas cars ran out of gas before people in their electric cars ran out of battery. And, you know, just because people were trying to stay warm in the car so you keep your engine running. And anyway, there was some journalists conducted a test with a Tesla. And again, I read this, you know, over 6 months ago, so I don't remember the fact. But he basically spent 12 or 13 hours in his car sitting in his driveway. And I don't know if he was writing emails, reading a book, or listening to music, but he kept the car at comfortable temperatures. And the car, which was on a pretty low charge already, the car fared well for over 12 or 13 hours. And that's all I remember. But you know, the bottom line is whether you're driving an electric car or you're driving a gasoline-powered car, diesel-powered car, you know, in the winter, don't drive until you run on empty. You know, if you're at a half a tank or a third of a tank, it's time to look for fuel or a battery charge.
And empty means either fuel or electric charge,
yeah.
As Jay is saying. The situation, I don't know about that specific test. I find it a little interesting. We don't know I don't know whether there was a temperature situation, 0 degrees versus 32 degrees versus 35. But there's already a lot of talk about what cold weather does to ranges once you drive out of your driveway with your charged battery from your charger overnight. Obviously, Jay will bring up that there are heaters for the batteries. My a hybrid, for example, runs much less efficiently in the wintertime. I've made several comments about it, but it's not a range anxiety vulnerable because it is a hybrid, which means I have a gasoline engine to take over when the battery doesn't have any oomph to move me forward. But if you're parking your car outside, you also have a probably lesser range once you start up in the morning than if you're parking your car in a garage. And there's already discussion about whether or not you should park some of these cars in garages at all because of fires that have been going on. But that's another matter to deal with. But I also understand that hot weather, to finish that hot weather and cold weather situation I started a few moments ago in this show, hot weather is also an enemy of battery life in electric cars. And I'm not sure where it goes in range situations, but batteries have to be cooled as much as they have to be warmed. So the electric car industry has been maturing, as I started out with minutes, moments ago, and people are making decisions about whether or not they want to buy an electric car on some of the things they're hearing. Some of the stories are probably not exactly correct in their details of the problems, but you never hear about normal situations saying it's just fine. You always hear about the problems. So we're going to watch, and Jay and I think mentioned on an earlier show that the sales have slowed a little bit, although they're still humming along pretty well, but manufacturers have started readjusting their production rates for electric vehicles because they are perceiving that there has been lessening of demand, partly because of the cost of electric cars and partly because of some of the stories coming out saying that
I'm not
the electric
sure the
cars are not
slowing.
All they're crumped up to be.
I'm not sure the demand is slowing in absolute terms. I think
no, I don't think in absolute
slowing,
terms it is.
But there's still a strong... I mean, that demand for electric cars is still growing, and there are more and more electric cars on the market. I think one of the incentives, of course, is always money, right? So
right.
The list is out now for the cars that are eligible for tax credits in 2024. And the tax credits have a bunch of criteria that the cars have to meet, but also obviously the person buying the car. So it has to be a personally owned vehicle. There are income
limitations,
but there's also a lower income limit, if I may say, because the tax credit has to be taken in one sum. So you cannot if you have. If you're eligible for a $7,500 tax credit and you don't have to pay $7,500 in taxes, you cannot carry over that credit over another year. But anyway, the list of cars for 2024 is pretty short. Chevy Bolt, the Ford F-150. I was surprised to see that the Mustang Mach-E was not on the list, and that leads me to believe that. Some of the components are whether it's a battery or other components are not made in the U.S. and that is one of the conditions
criteria
for cars to be eligible. Most Teslas are eligible. Rivians are eligible, but only for half the credit, $3,750. And there's also a short list of plug-in hybrids, the Chrysler minivan, the Chrysler Pacifica. Gets the full $7,500 tax credit eligibility. The Ford Escape, the Jeep Grand Cherokee, and both the Ford Escape, the Jeep Wrangler, and the Lincoln Corsair are the other ones on the short list, and they're all eligible for half that $7,500 tax credit. And that's it. That's the list for 2024, as far as I can see.
Well, the manufacturers are starting to get creative to jump in here. A couple of manufacturers, mainly, I think it's Kia and or Hyundai, by saying that they will help assist in either the total cost of putting in a charging station at your home or part of it. And that is another way that you may get a benefit if you're hesitant about buying an electric car because of the cost factor. I'm not sure. I seem to hear that level 2 charging ports at cars are costing somewhere between $1,500 and $2,500. Jay, do you know whether that's correct or not? So that's not a lot, but when electric cars are all up around $45,000 to $65,000 before tax credits, that can, you know, that might just tip the scale of somebody's willingness to buy an electric car. If Kia, for example, offered to pay for the installation of a level 2 charging port, as opposed to giving you $2,500 off or whatever the case might be. So there are going to be creative ways to try to keep supporting people's desire to buy an electric car if they are questioning it for one reason or another. And that's one way. One manufacturer is talking about assisting somebody in wanting to buy a car, helping them want to buy their car probably.
So I just a little story. I drove down to Florida. It's the time of year when I do a few trips down to Florida, drive either southbound or northbound. And I just drove down to Florida this past week. You know, 2 days of driving. I don't do anything stupid. I'm too old to do the 18 hours straight, no sleeping. And I think it's just ridiculous anyway. So 1,200-mile trip down to Vero Beach. In a nice little C-Class Mercedes, fairly recent car, and a few comments to that effect. First of all, you know, I use an iPhone, and when I got into the car, I wanted to connect CarPlay to the car, to the Mercedes-Benz
Apple system.
System, you know, car system. They call it Command. You know, plugging in the USB-C port in the dashboard of a car usually connects your phone pretty quickly and immediately, and CarPlay becomes available. I use CarPlay whenever I can. I don't have it in my car because my car is too old, and CarPlay did not exist at the time, was not offered. But I'm always surprised to see how many people have the function and do not use it. So. It is, you know, we use Waze or Google Maps as a primary means of navigation, and having it on the dashboard of the car as opposed to on your phone and having to look on your phone is certainly
a big help.
Safety plus, right?
Right.
Also answering the phone. The phone is automatically connected to the car, and you eliminate all that looking at the phone and all the dangers that come with that. But, and I guess my only little beef here was that every time I connected the phone to the car, the way to get to the connection was a little tedious and not always the same. And sometimes I had to go through the process a couple of times. Just a little bit frustrating. But my point is, you still have to go through the process. It's still a great feature.
So learn to use it is really what you want to tell us.
Well, and when you get in a car, learn how to use the car. I mean, this particular car, and I love the car, but there are a lot of functions. There are a lot of functions on the steering wheel. What is most puzzling, I think, in some of these new cars is that you have the same function can be served by different buttons, and can be on the dash. One or two of the buttons on the wheel, and it takes time figuring out what knob or button or does what.
Okay.
The good news about the Mercedes commands system control, you know, is that the dash there's no touch screen. It's all a mechanical input. So there's a wheel, and then you actually that's not true.
That's not true. I have never driven one, but I don't think that's true.
There is a small pad under your hand, but not on the dash. So it works pretty well.
Okay. Let me jump in because we're running out of time, I think. You better watch. And this is a big problem for rental cars. That's when people who are used to have become familiar with their own cars with all these features go to an airport in some other place, rent a car, and it's not the same way. There's no uniformity, unfortunately. And I think this needs to be a standard of uniformity so that there wouldn't be this confusion that reigns among different vehicles, and you drive a lot of different vehicles, so I don't know how different your story about the Mercedes is from when you're driving a Porsche or a Audi or something like that. But uniformity is not known to be a major thing, and they're running into that with the charging ports now. As you mentioned, Jay, Tesla charging plans are going to be available on Ford, Chevys, and all that, which is like the old VHS tape situation, the other tape. I can't even remember what it was decades ago. So it was good to hear your story about it. I'm a little confused by whether or not you were having trouble in the same car with these different ways to connect. It should be one way every time you get in any car.
Well,
like my Jeep.
This was my short beef, the same car, the system did not react
hook up
the
same
way every time,
yeah,
which was a little puzzling. But
for that type of car, ridiculous.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a great car, by the way. And,
okay, great.
Driving up and down I-95 is always an experience. And
is the traffic
around,
pretty thick on 95 all every time you go on one of these trips?
No, this was a holiday. I mean, I drove on January 1st and 2nd, and the traffic was absolutely crazy all the way down the Northeast Corridor. So from, you know, through New York City, New Jersey Turnpike,
Washington,
Delaware Bridge, and through Baltimore and D.C., The good news was that the express lanes in through D.C. were working in my favor, and you know, I was able to cross D.C. actually faster than expected.
Okay.
Time. But the only thing that happened, the only slowdown I had, was a dog jumped out of a car on I-95. You know, there's always something different happening. But
which brings to the safety thing for the finish of the show, if we're there. Dogs are hanging out of windows in cars, and it's really interesting. The question is, are dogs prone to do what you saw happen? Because it's amazing how many dogs are hanging quite far out of windows in pickup trucks and in some people's vehicles. And you wonder if they see something that if they weren't in a vehicle but on the ground outside they'd want to go after, they would just jump out of a car like what happened in front of you.
Well,
not
really,
fun.
Dogs should be fastened like passengers in the car.
Probably they should have a seatbelt leash or something.
They do, and they do exist.
And the other thing you have to worry about dogs is if the windows don't have an auto-up safety feature or they have down and the dogs are on the arm handles and that's where the switches are, the windows could go down with the dog paws on them.
That's our safety tip for the week.
Yes.
We're out
of time. Watch out when you have a pet in a car.
There you go.